I'm Brenda B, and I'm an addict.
Brenda.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
All the way back?
Yeah.
Okay. My name is Brenda B, and I'm a drug addict. And I want to welcome the newcomers. If you're here for your first, second, or third meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, hope you hear something that keeps you coming back. And if you're just back from a relapse, welcome home. There's, no shame in relapsing. The shame is in not coming back. And so welcome home. And I've had a challenging week. I just got out of the hospital yesterday with a lung infection. My right lung has been infected, and they don't know what that's from or how I got that or how I could prevent myself from getting that again. But if I tend to sound like I'm winded, that's because of my lung. And so I hope that you'll just bear with me, and I'll share at my own pace tonight. I'm going to tell a little bit about what it was like for me before I got to Narcotics Anonymous. I grew up in a house where my father was chemically dependent. He was a drug addict, and he was a rageaholic. And he was a very violent, brutal alcoholic. And rarely did a day go by that my mother or us kids or our pets were not brutalized by my father, because he drank every day, and when he drank, something happened to him, and he turned into this violent, cruel, mean person. And the other part of that is that I really love my dad. He died a few years ago, and before he died, I was able to bring some closure to that part of my life. But the effects that growing up in a chemically dependent family had on me personally were pretty profound. And that's what I'm going to share some of with you tonight. From as far back as I could remember, I never felt like I was good enough. I never felt like I was smart enough, pretty enough, talented enough, witty enough, clever enough. Just never enough. I'm never going to be enough to measure up. And there were some things that happened in that house that gave me some beliefs about myself. I remember being 5 years old and getting up on top of a chair to wash the dishes in the kitchen, and the glasses were slippery. They were glasses, and they were slippery, and they would slip out of my hands and crash down into the floor and break. And my father, who was drunk in the bedroom, would hear those glasses break in the kitchen floor, and he would come charging out of that bedroom, and he would say, "Who broke that goddamn glass?" Now, I'm all of 5 years old. I'm so little that I got to stand on a chair to get these dishes washed. But in my head, I already am an odds player. I play the odds. I know that if I tell my dad the truth, I'm going to get an ass whipping. I know that if I lie and get caught, I'm going to get the leather strap. I'm going to get an ass whipping. I know that if I'm really sneaky and I lie and I get away with it, then maybe, just maybe, I'll get away and stay safe and keep myself from being hurt. And so early in my life, one of the primary themes was set, that I learned how to be sneaky, I learned how to be dishonest, and for me it was a matter of personal safety. It was a matter of keeping myself safe. And I continued that theme in my life for the rest of my life. I still can be sneaky today, although today it's like a red flag that pops up, and I get to like take a look at what is it that I'm really trying to be dishonest about here, because they go hand in hand for me. Anytime I find myself trying to be sneaky about something or trying to hide something from you guys or other people in my life, it's because there's something I'm being dishonest about. When I really am self-disclosing and opening my life, I don't have to worry about being sneaky. My life just unfolds. There were some other things that I learned in that house. My dad would brutalize my mother every day. My mother would work outside of the home. She worked 7 days a week just to put food on our table. My father didn't work one day that I can recall through my whole childhood. And there were seven of us kids. We lived in a 750-square-foot one-bedroom house in central Oklahoma. And, you know, some of the things I came to believe is that there's not enough space for me, and there's not enough time for me, and there's not enough love for me. There was never enough of my mom to go around for all of us kids. I was the fourth of six daughters, and so I had three older sisters, and I had two sisters younger than me, and then my parents had a little boy. I believe that if the boy had been born much sooner, that my parents probably would have stopped reproducing. And I believe that I got a lot of messages about myself being a girl, that somehow I didn't measure up. Like there were other messages I got there too. I heard my dad tell my mom repeatedly that women are whores and women are sluts and women are bitches. And I remember when my body started to change and I started to go through puberty, I remember thinking, oh my God, it's happening. Up until that time in my life, I did everything I could to try and be a boy. I climbed trees, I built forts, I played baseball, I could run faster than anybody. I mean, I just like tried so hard. I wore jeans, I had a boy's haircut, I just tried so hard to be a boy. Because boys in the environment I grew up in, boys were valued. My dad wanted a son more than he wanted anything. And I'm telling you, by the time he got his fourth daughter, he really wanted a son. He really did not want a little girl. And so I believe that that things were already set for me to be devalued in my life right from the gate. Just being born and being female, I believe that I already had been devalued. And when I started to go through puberty and my body began to change, I was so uncomfortable with the changes, because now I'm becoming a woman. And you all know that women are sluts and whores and bitches. And there was no way out of it. There was no way for me to get out of that. And so what happened for me was I picked up and started using. And I made a very important discovery. I discovered that if you put enough drugs into your body on a regular basis, you can go from feeling like nothing to feeling like you're almost okay most of the time. And if you've been a nothing all your life and you find something that makes you feel like you're almost, it's like being king of the hill, you know? It's like being top of the rock. And so I found something that made me feel like I was almost okay. I could almost be the life of the party. I could almost be the prettiest girl at the dance. I could almost be witty, and I could almost be whatever I wanted to be if you put enough drugs into my body. And the first time I ever used drugs was 1965, and I continued to use drugs until September 14th, 1981. I first started trying to clean up in the summer of 1976. And in the summer of 1976, when you went to get treatment for chemical dependency, what they treated you for was alcoholism. And in the summer of 1976, when I went to get treatment for alcoholism, nobody asked me about other drugs in my life. We had moved to the projects of Seattle when I was 10 years old from a farm in Oklahoma, and talk about a displaced kid. I didn't fit in anywhere. I didn't fit in anywhere. And I began using drugs regularly in 1965. I continued to use until the fall of 1981. By that time, I had three kids that were living at home with me. Excuse me, I had four kids that were living at home with me. I had two biological kids that were 13 and 11, and two stepchildren that were a little bit younger than that. I was getting loaded on a regular basis. in the fall of 1981 with my two teenagers, with the 13-year-old and the 11-year-old. Those kids smoked pot with me from the time they were old enough to pick up a roach out of the ashtray. And and I didn't have any idea that I was an abusive mother. I thought that the lifestyle I was in was inevitable, that these kids were going to get into it sooner or later, and what better? How could it not be good for them to learn from me how to do it, right? And my entire life was centered and focused around the finding and getting ways to use the means to use. In September of 1981, I went to a party in the projects in Seattle. I went to a biker party, and I'd eaten a hit of acid. I was drinking straight black velvet. I'd done a couple of lines of cocaine when I started getting too high off the booze, and I remember taking this hit of acid and thinking to myself, this is bunk, it's not going to be very good, so it's probably just mainly speed cut, and that's what I was looking for, was the speed effect. And so I took that and I headed over to this party, and as I was coming up off of I-5 onto the Burien Freeway, I started peeking on that acid, and this freeway on-ramp sort of came up like a dragon's head and was looking at me, and I was tripping, I'll tell you. And I drove all the rest of the way over to that party, and I parked my car in front of the house where the party was at, and my ex-husband came out of the house and opened my car door, and I was so high that I could not stand up. He was so freaked out because I was so high that he took my car keys away from me. And I don't know how you guys are, but you get me behind a fifth of black velvet and take my car keys away, and you're ready. The fight's on, okay? The fight is on. And so I went on into the party and was trying to fight with everybody. Not a good attitude to be in, especially if you're in a biker party. And so my ex-husband was trying to sort of keep me safe from myself, you know, protect me from myself. So he came over and told me that I had to leave the party. He had to tell me that he didn't need me there, that I was a troublemaker, that he needed me to get out. And so I don't know what your last day loaded was like, but my last day loaded, I got thrown out of a biker party, okay? It's pretty interesting. So I left the party. They wouldn't give me my car keys. They kept my car. I left that party, and I went out into the middle of the street. I remember getting into the middle of the street. I remember lining myself up on the white line down the middle of the road, and I remember thinking to myself, if I just stay on this white line, it's going to take me wherever I need to go. And I walked into my last blackout. Two days later, they found me in the BlackBerry stickers off of Pacific Highway South, out by SeaTac Airport. I had a broken jaw. I had a fractured skull. The left side of my face had been shattered. My eye socket was shattered. My left eyeball had been knocked out of the socket. And they loaded me into an ambulance and took me to the hospital. I was in intensive care for 10 days. And while I was in intensive care, I made a decision that the one thing I was absolutely certain of that morning is that I'm a drug addict, and that if I don't do something to change my lifestyle, I am probably going to die loaded. And so I made a decision that as soon as I was able to get out of that hospital, that I was going to try to get to a meeting. The only meeting that I knew about was the meetings I'd heard about when I was in treatment in 1976. And that scared me, because I knew that the truth was that I didn't just have a problem with alcohol, that I had a problem with all the drugs that I was using. And that was the truth for me. And so, you know what happened for me, you guys, was laying in that hospital bed in intensive care, I made a phone call to the 24-hour line for Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is my story, so I can say that. Because that's what happened, was I called the 24-hour line for Alcoholics Anonymous. And as soon as that woman picked up the phone, I said to her, you know what? I don't just have a problem with alcohol. I'm a drug addict. I can't stop using drugs. And they're killing me. I'm going to die loaded if I don't find a different way to live. And she said to me that she had heard about a program called Narcotics Anonymous, and that she would try to find a phone number and she would call me back. And after about 15 minutes, the phone in that room rang and I picked it up and there was a woman on the other end. She said, my name is Alice and I'm a drug addict. And Alice came every day while I was in that hospital and brought the message of hope to me, the message of hope that is Narcotics Anonymous. And when I was able to get out of the hospital and had a few days clean out on the street, I made an agreement that I'd meet Alice at a meeting. At that time, in the fall of 1981, there were two meetings in this state. They were both in Seattle. There was no basic text. There were a couple of informational pamphlets, and I didn't have any idea how I was ever going to stay clean. The one thing that I was absolutely sure of is that I'm a drug addict and that I've got to do something different in my life. And the other thing I was absolutely sure of is that if there really was a God, like they talked about in the meetings, that God wasn't going to have time for some low life like me. I felt really certain about that. And so I thought that really the best I could hope for was to, the very best that I could hope for was to just get as far as I could get before God realized what a mistake he'd made. And then I would have to go on to the bitter end, which is always jails, institutions, or death. Always. I remember climbing the stairs. I told Alice that I'd meet her at the Fremont meeting on Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock in Seattle. And back then, they didn't let us have meetings like in churches and stuff. Churches, as soon as you contact a church and tell them you were a member of Narcotics Anonymous and you wanted to have a meeting in their church, they would like shut down. They did not want to hear any more about it. There were a couple of renegade meetings that were meeting in people's houses around. But I climbed the stairs to that meeting up in Fremont that Saturday afternoon. When I pushed open the door, the whole room, which probably consisted of 15 or 20 chairs, all the chairs were full, and there were some addicts standing up in the back of the room. And Alice had told me that she'd wear a red shirt. And as I pushed open the door, I told her she could easily identify me. I'm the one with the two black eyes and the busted jaw. I'll be easy to identify. And as soon as I pushed open the door, a woman in the back with a red shirt on jumped up and she came forward. And she knew that I'd just gotten out of the hospital and that I was too sick to stand up all the way through the meeting. She told me later that she had threatened those guys that if they didn't leave that chair empty for the newcomer, she was going to kill them. And she came over and took a hold of my arm, and she took me over to that chair, and she sat me down in that chair. And as it turned out, I was sitting across this table from a biker. And this guy was, you know, I knew that this guy had been down the road a time or two. He had tats all up and down. He had time dots where he'd done time in the penitentiary, and he had teardrops tattooed on his face. And I knew that he'd been riding hard for a long time. And After a while, this drug addict that was across the table from me started talking. He started sharing about his experience in Narcotics Anonymous. And I remember I had so much shame and humiliation and degradation that I could not look anybody in this room in the eye. But as that drug addict was sitting across from me talking, I felt compelled to pull my face up and look into his eyes. And I think it was the tone of his voice. There was a tone to his voice that I had never heard before. And it sounded, what he was saying sounded authentic. And I felt like there was really something that this guy had. And I remember pulling my face up and looking that drug addict in the eye. And I remember for the first time, I looked in the eyes of a clean drug addict and seeing the light. And I had never seen the light in the eyes of any of the drug addicts I'd ever used with, ever. And I remember looking in that drug addict's eyes, seeing the light, and thinking to myself, you know what? I don't know what this guy's got, but I want a piece of the action. I want a piece of this. And I remember saying to myself that day, I will do whatever I have to do to be the one. I'd heard some of the old-timers sit in meetings, and they'd say, you know what? Out of the 10 people in this meeting, only one of us is going to make it. And I remember thinking, well, you guys are fucked. Hey, you guys, I mean, I'm sorry, but I'm going to be the one. I'm the one. And I didn't like it when they said that, because I wanted everybody in there to make it, you know. But they said it, and they said that stuff a lot. And I just, every time they said it and every time I heard it, I became more and more determined that I was going to be the one. I actually have come to find out that I'm kind of a rare breed in Narcotics Anonymous. And by that, what I mean is that since my first day in a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, I have never used again. Never have used again. So, you know, the message about that is not that there's something wrong with people who relapse. I think it takes whatever it takes for every one of us. And for me, once I heard the message, there was no looking back for me. And I think that the message that I get to carry to newcomers is not a message about relapse, but a message that, you know what? Relapse is not a prerequisite for long-term recovery. You can come to Narcotics Anonymous and stay clean from the gate. And the way that you do that is you do not pick up and use no matter what happens, no matter what. Now, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what the ensuing 19 and a half years have been like. I did not have a clue what recovery held for me. If I had, I probably never would have got my 30-day chip, and that's the truth. Because I just would have been overwhelmed. I would not have any idea that I could ever have made it through some of the stuff that I've made it through. When I got clean and got into recovery, I was unemployed and unemployable. I'd been on welfare for 18 years. I lived in subsidized housing with my kids. I was doing drugs on a regular basis with my two teenagers. My fourth marriage was on its way down the tubes. And the only reason I hadn't asked that guy to leave was because I had two stepchildren in that marriage that I'd raised since they were little babies. And I knew that if he left, he was going to take those babies with him. And my attachment to them was far greater than my attachment to him. And in the early years of my recovery, I remember that there were times when I went to 5 meetings a day. And there weren't enough NA meetings around for me to be able to just go to Narcotics Anonymous. So I had to do whatever I had to do to stay clean and support my recovery in those early years. In the spring of 1982, the basic text came out, and I'm telling you, it was like the best drug I'd ever got in my hands. It was like the best narcotic, because now I could pick up a book. And actually, it was probably November of 1981 that the pre-approved edition came out for literature reviews. Right now they're doing literature reviews around on sponsorship. Are some of you involved in those? Well, that's the same kind of stuff that they did before the basic text, the first edition, was printed. was that any literature that's approved by the fellowship has to be approved by the members. That's us. We're the members. We have the most important say at any meeting. We get to vote that literature in or nix it, and we worked and worked and worked. We did literature reviews for months on that first edition basic text, and I still have today. I still have a copy of the pre-approved manuscripts that went around for literature review, and they're pretty rare, pretty hard to find. Anyway, you know, the first thing I can tell you about my recovery was that everything back there felt overwhelming. I was the parent of teenage kids, didn't have a clue how to parent. Not a clue. I didn't even have a clue how to do life. My husband was still getting loaded in our house. And so I would go to meetings and I would come home and the drugs would be, you know, like there would be lines of cocaine on the mirror and there would be joints twisted up in the ashtray and there would be some long neck Rainiers in the refrigerator. And I'm trying to stay clean. And we did that for like 15 months. When I was 15 months clean, he made a decision to leave the relationship. And when he left, he made a decision to leave those two little kids with me because he knew that I was going to do a better job at that point than he was doing. So I got this job cooking in this Greasy Spoon restaurant, and we started having these little NA meetings back in the cocktail lounge. And my sponsor and my sponsor's husband and all my little friends from recovery would come, and I'd close up on like 8 o'clock on a Tuesday night, and we'd all go in the cocktail lounge and have this little NA meeting that we had started there. And we started to get meetings in South King County. The Kent Valley meeting was born in the fall of 1981, and then Friday Night Alive was born. And from there, in early 1982, they had the first meetings over here at St. Gabe's over in Port Orchard. The first meetings in West Puget Sound area were born over there. A guy named Dan M. And we would all come over and help support those meetings. And Olympia got born, and Everett got born, and we started taking the message across. We had one guy had a van, like this old hippie bus, and we started taking the message over to these freelancers that were over in Eastern Washington, over in Yakima, Wenatchee, and Spokane. And we had this traveling meeting where we... Hey, they'll let anybody in here. They're cute, but you know. Anyway, gosh, I can't believe all my friends would actually. I'm always amazed when people that I know who have heard my story 10,000 times like come to hear me, because I think, what could they possibly get from one more time, you know? And like, that's the part of my thinking that is my disease. That's the part of me that, no matter what, finds it really hard to believe that people would just come to support me because they love me. You know, that people would really come to support me because they value me as a person. And I feel some sadness even as I say that. I'd gotten this job. Oh gosh, that wasn't even my first job. I'll tell you, you know, there's this line in the basic text that says social acceptability does not equal recovery. In my case, that was not true. And while social acceptability does not equal recovery, it certainly is a first step for many of us. And I was like one of those where, like, the first step was to become socially acceptable, just to be able to show up and know how to behave appropriately in meetings was a first step for me in my recovery. And I actually had a hard time with that. I lied a little earlier and told you my first job was in this restaurant cooking. But That was actually job number two. Job number one, my sponsor had told me, she was kind of, you know, talking to me about, geez, you know, we are self-supporting through our own contributions, Brenda, and I think 18 years on welfare is a little much. Like, maybe it's time, darling. And so she started encouraging me to go find a job. And we talked about that. I went up to the farm and I sat down and we talked about, well, what could I do? And she said, well, you know, you do really okay with these kids. Maybe you could work in a daycare. I said, Lou, I hate kids. Okay? I hate them. I especially hate the ones that live at my house. Okay? So that's not going to work for me. So then she said, well, you're a really good housekeeper. Have you thought about, like, maybe you could be, like, you know, Molly Maids or, you know, like one of those. And I said, no. I hate cleaning house. I hate cleaning house. The reason my house looks so good is because I threaten to kill the kids if they don't keep it clean, okay? I hate cleaning house. So we just talked about it, you know, and the stuff I felt like I was really good at was either immoral or illegal. So the prospects weren't looking too good. Anyway, she told me I needed to get a job. So I got the newspaper out, and I started looking for a job, and I saw this position. It was a sales position, and it sounded, you know, it's like, must have a fun personality, talks easily to people, blah, 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 blah. And I thought, well, that's me. I can do that. And so I called this phone number for this job, and I made an appointment to meet this guy like the following Wednesday. And on Wednesday, I met this guy in a coffee shop, and he talked to me about the position that he was hiring for, and he told me that he thought I'd be great. And so I accepted the job, and I went home that night. I called my sponsor, and I said, you're not going to believe it, but I got a job today. I'd only been looking like 3 days. And she said, you're kidding me. What are you going to be doing? I said, I'm going to be selling vibrators door to door. And I had every intention of getting off welfare and getting out of that subsidized housing besides. And some of you that were around back then, boy, they gave me a hard time in meetings. I am telling you, I had this bumper sticker on the back. I had the 66 Dodge Dart, one of those, like one of those old slant six engines. You know, these things run forever. All you got to do is put gas and oil in them. They run till the wheels fall off. This car was so rusted out that I got hit in the parking lot at Kmart. And the rear quarter panel just kind of crumbled up and fell out. It didn't even dent. It just crumbled up because it was so rusted. I stopped at a traffic light in downtown Kent, down on Central, and my son fell through the floorboard. And I had to cut this piece of plywood to put in the floor back there so my kids could like not fall through. Anyway, I had it going on in those early years, I want you to know. And I was really cute besides. I was much younger then. I was really cute. And, yeah, so. And to say the least, the way I dressed was rather provocative. And there are some men around today who still will tell you that seeing me at meetings is what got them clean. I'm thinking it probably wasn't my message of recovery either. Anyway, so, like, I went on this mission selling these vibrators at meetings and stuff. And you know how today... you know how today the literature chairman, like, pulls in the parking lot and he opens his trunk and then he starts selling literature out of the back of the car or everybody comes out and they buy literature, right? Well, I was selling vibrators. And my sponsor kept saying things to me like, Brenda, do you think that this job is conducive to a spiritual way of life? And I would say things like, Lou, I got this one that is definitely conducive to a spiritual way. I mean, this is like spiritual. The good news about recovery is that if you stay here long enough, you will get the chance to live down your reputation in recovery. You really will get to live your reputation down in recovery if you stay clean long enough and you don't use no matter what. Because I guarantee you that sooner or later you're going to get to the place in recovery where it feels like everybody's talking about you and your shit. And if you have the courage to not use no matter what, you will survive it. And you'll be a better person on the other side. And you know what? So will they. They will too. They'll get their growth out of that. So, I don't remember how long I did that job, but eventually I decided that it probably was not conducive to a spiritual way of life. Just because I was having a hard time hanging on to my serenity in meetings with all these fools dogging me about it all the time. And so, So I quit that job, and I went to work in this little restaurant. We started having meetings. Life began to change. I made a decision that I probably was never going to get ahead in my life if I didn't get an education. And so I went back down. I got laid off at the job is what happened. I had to go back down and apply for public assistance. And I don't know how you guys are, but for me, that felt like a real step backward in recovery. I felt like I was really going backward instead of forward. And I thought that there was really something wrong with me. And there's a guy in this room. Now, when I was in my third year of recovery, this guy saved my life. He saved my life literally. Not just saved me by helping me stay clean, but he literally saved my life. I'd gotten laid off from that job. I had to go back down and apply for public assistance. I felt like I was going backward in my recovery instead of forward. And I was so depressed that I could not get out of the house. I could not get out of the house. And I'd been in this depression for about a month. And, you know, it's like one of those depressions where you sleep until noon, you keep all the the drapes are all closed and the phone's like off the hook so nobody can call, and you don't answer the door, and at 1 o'clock you find yourself sitting in front of the TV watching Jerry Springer. And you haven't done any of your personal grooming stuff, so your teeth feel like they have those little sweaters crocheted on them. Yeah, that kind of stuff. And it doesn't matter. Because you're not going to go anywhere, right? It doesn't matter that there's dishes that have been in the sink for 3 weeks and that they got green stuff growing on them now. None of that mattered because I could not get myself out of it. And what happened was this guy showed up one day and told me he was going to take me grocery shopping. And he made me get dressed. We went down to this little store by my house and he bought me, I don't know, at least $100 worth of groceries. And we took those groceries back to my house, and the next morning when I got up, I felt even more depressed because now not only am I going backward in recovery, but now I owe somebody in recovery $100. And I was sure that if he didn't let me pay him back, he was probably going to want to take it out some other way, because those were the kind of guys I hung with before I got here. Gas, grass, or ass. Nobody rides for free. And I didn't want to have to pay. You know, I didn't want to have to pay. And although he hadn't mentioned that ever. And you know what happened that morning in my third year of recovery was that about 8 o'clock somebody knocked on my door. And it was a member of Narcotics Anonymous. And that drug addict showed up, and I'm like looking through the peek hole, and it's like, oh, great. I open the door, and it's like, yeah, what do you want? And he said, I just want a cup of coffee. I said, I'm not making no coffee. Like, go to a meeting, get a coffee. And he said, no, I want to come in and have a cup of coffee. I'll make it. Do you mind if I make it? And I said, no, you know. So like, he came in, and I was feeling resentful, just hateful. And so I just sat on the couch in my pajamas where I'd been for 3 weeks. And he, like, proceeded to clean all the dishes up in my kitchen sink and wash all the mold down the sink. And he cleaned the coffee pot, and he made a pot of coffee for himself. And about 9 o'clock, there was a knock on the door. And I look out the peek hole, and there's two more drug addicts, a guy and a girl. And they're standing on my front door. And I opened the door, and I said, "Did he call you guys?" And they said, "Who?" And I said, and they peeked in the kitchen and said, "No, we've just been worried about you. You haven't been at meetings." See, back then, the meetings were so small. If one person disappeared for one meeting, everybody knew. And if you disappeared for one meeting, they came looking for you. And they'd been coming looking for me, you know. They'd come, like, trying to peek in my sliding glass doors, and I had them draped shut as hard as I could so they couldn't see in there, you know. They'll not find me. Anyway, those two came in, and the guy in the kitchen said, "Oh, you guys want a cup of coffee?" And I'm thinking, it ain't even his house. He's like being the host, you know? So he invites these other two drug addicts in. Now there's three of them, and they're all sitting at my dining room table, and they're drinking coffee, and they're smoking cigarettes. They decide to get a game of dominoes going. So they're playing dominoes at my dining room table. Knock, knock, knock. There's a knock at the door. I look out the peephole. There's another drug addict standing out there. I open him up. I said, "Get your own cup." I'm not even talking to you about it. By 2 in the afternoon, I had a poker party going at my dining room table, all clean and sober recovering drug addicts, all members of Narcotics Anonymous. And you know what? They were not going to leave until I told them that I would go with them to a meeting. They were not going to leave. And I remember sitting there on that couch, and I was like defiantly hanging on to that resentment, you know? Like, "Oh, you bastards, you don't even, I can't even sit here and be fucked up by myself, you know? Like, you just have to come over here and find me." And I remember, like, sitting on my couch watching these guys. They were laughing and drinking their coffee, and you know what? It was like somebody turned the light on. It was like the light came on, and I realized that what was happening was that God was saving me from myself when I was incapable of rescuing myself. That God, and I hadn't even sought God, I hadn't even been able to talk to God because my despair had been so profound. And you know what? Even though I couldn't reach out to God, God still saved my life that day. And that was a turning point for me. I got back to a meeting that night. And the next day I got to a meeting. And I went back to doing 90 meetings in 90 days. And I got back on track. And within a short period of time, I realized that being on welfare was a blessing from some power greater than myself. Because you know what? Being on public assistance allowed me to qualify for loans and grants that I never could have gotten if I was still working. And I was able to get loans and grants, and I was able to go to college. And DSHS, they'd sent me to pipefitter's school back in the 70s. And I got my certification, you know, as a plumber and a pipefitter. So when I told them I wanted to go back to school to go into chemical dependency counseling, they said, "You know, we already paid for you to go to school. We already paid." But I had this guy from DVR that really believed in me, and he really believed in my recovery, and he really thought that I was going to be able to do what I said I was going to do, which was stay clean and make something out of myself. And so that guy advocated for me, and DSHS came forward and said that they would pay for a year of college. So I had took 2 years to get a certificate, and in order to do it in a year's time, I really had to kick ass and take names later, you know? And I did it. I had to challenge courses. When you challenge the course, that means you do all the coursework, including the midterm and the finals, all the paperwork that has to go in without ever actually attending the class. So I pushed myself My kids were getting a little older. They were 16 and 14 by then. They were more capable of taking care of themselves. And I challenged myself, and I finished that two-year certificate in a year with a 4.0 and graduated with honors. And I have, from that day to this day, I have never applied for a job in my field. The day I graduated, a friend of mine who was in recovery and was running a little agency down in Kent called me and asked me if I would like to go to work for him. I told him that I would. And so I started my first job in 1987. So I got in on the beginning of that, and from that job, I went to work at King County Assessment Center doing ADATS assessments. I stayed there for 13 years, and a couple of years ago, I was approached by my manager and asked if I would consider a position as the involuntary commitment specialist for drug addicts in King County. And that's what I do today, is I put drug addicts in treatment, and sometimes I put them in treatment against their will. And I take it very seriously when I'm out there depriving people of their civil rights. I think God's really blessed me and has really used me as an instrument of his will and his way of life. I had a really hard time getting the 12 steps and getting the whole recovery concept when I got here. It seemed like all my attention was focused on just trying to, like, take care of the kids, go to school, keep the house, do the dishes. You know, I mean, all of that stuff. It was just overwhelming. I felt like I was on overwhelm all the time. And I had a really hard time trying to get any understanding of how the steps worked and how recovery itself worked. And my sponsor used to tell me, like, little stories. And then from that, I used to, like, have experiences, and I began to see that, like, this was like a story that was unfolding, this story of my recovery. And there was a lot of work to be done in those early years because Narcotics Anonymous truly was being born in the state of Washington. And there was far more addicts than there were meetings, and we had to, it's like every person had six service positions. You know, you were the coffee maker at that meeting, and then over here you were the secretary, and then over there you were the treasurer, and then down there you were the GSR, and then besides that you were the area public information person, you know, and everybody had all the service positions. It wasn't just one or two people, because there was so much work that needed to be done, and there were so many meetings that we needed. I'll never forget the day when we got to the day where there were enough meetings of Narcotics Anonymous in the greater Puget Sound area that I could go to one meeting of Narcotics Anonymous every day. It was like a miracle had happened. That was like the payoff for all those, all that dedicated service work. And, you know, if you're one of those people that you get shit about being a service junkie, I just really, you've got my blessing. I just really want you to know you got my blessing. And, you know, if you're one of those people who has been given the gift of recovery and you're not giving back through service, I hope that you'll take a look at that. Like, what's that about for you? You know, this is a gift. My recovery is a gift that has cost me nothing. I had to give up the pain, the humiliation, the degradation. It cost me, that's what it cost me. And not only that, but you guys told me that you would gladly refund all my misery if I wanted it back. And you know what? I believed you. I believed you. And I think that I could never be enough, do enough, say enough, work hard enough. I've been taking NA meetings into the women's prison at Purdy for 15 years. Since December of 1985, we took the first meetings of Narcotics Anonymous into the women's prison at Purdy and also into McNeil Island. And that was interesting. It was a very interesting time. to be able to call the administrator at McNeil Island and say, yeah, my name is Brenda B., I'm a drug addict, and I'd like to bring a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous into your men's prison. They said, what? So I took Black Willie with me from Seattle. Y'all know little short Willie P. Willie P. I took Willie with me and figured I'd let him do the strong arm stuff. And you know what? We took God along. We took God on that ferry ride over to meet with them that day. And you know what? They let us start that first meeting. And they told us that the first time a meeting went haywire, that it would be all over. And you know, Freedom Behind Bars meeting of Narcotics Anonymous is still going today. Still going today. When I was about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years clean, I'd already become a grandmother. I've been a grandmother almost 15 years now. And my oldest grandson was about 5 years old, I think, and I took him to... I'd made so many mistakes. I mean, from selling vibrators out of the trunks of my car to God knows what, you know. I just felt like I was an example of, like I was a bad example of recovery. That's what I believed about myself. I was not one of those people who came here and in 90 days got it all together. Got the job, the house, the car, got the old man back, you know. I was not one of those people. It took me years to get out of that 63 Dodge Dart with the plywood in the back. And you know, when I was about from 5 to 8 years clean, it was a very difficult time for me because I'd been around long enough to create a reputation in recovery, but I hadn't been around long enough to live it down yet. And it was pretty devastating. And I really didn't think much of my experience, strength, and hope. Really didn't think I had much to share. And I took my oldest grandson for his birthday. He'd been asking me for, he'd been telling me that he wanted some karate instructions. He wanted to get karate classes. So I'd made this contact in Auburn for this guy, and he was a Japanese master, a black belt at karate. And I bought him this, like, gift for his birthday, and the first night I took him to this karate class, and it was in this old school gymnasium, and they had all these little 4 and 5 year olds up on this school stage, and they were like, you know, 4 and 5 year olds, they were like picking their butt and picking their nose, and they were like being 4 and 5 year olds, and they were so cute, and I was just loving them. And And this Japanese guy seemed a little rigid to me. I thought he was actually a little anal retentive. Seemed a little rigid. But I was trying to break myself out of judgments that year, so I decided not to get too carried away with that. And I remember that he was giving these little kids, he was like doing the ceremony with them where they were starting out, and he was giving them all this little white belt. And then he had this black felt pen in his hand, and he told these kids that every time they made a mistake in his class, that he would take this black felt pen and make a mark on their little white belts so everyone would know. And I remember sitting in the audience and thinking to myself, this guy's a scumbag. He's going to, like, shame these little kids into performing the way that he wants them to perform. And, of course, went right off into those judgments, didn't I? See how fast that happens? And while I was continuing to be off into my head, after a while I came back, and then I heard him tell these little kids, in order to get really good at karate, you have to make a lot of mistakes, and you have to be willing, you have to have the courage to keep coming back, even when you've made a lot of mistakes. And if you keep coming back, and you keep making mistakes, and you keep learning from your mistakes, one of these days your white belt is going to be completely black, and you're going to be a master at karate. That guy didn't know there was a drug addict sitting in the audience that day. And you know what? Up until that day, I felt like when I got here, I got a white belt of recovery. And I felt like I had to keep that white belt white no matter what. And if you guys found out I was getting black marks on it, it was going to be devastating to my self-esteem. And that guy gave me permission that day to hold my little white belt of recovery up with all of the black marks I had on it and start telling you guys the truth that I'm making mistakes. I'm making so many mistakes, you guys. I have made some huge mistakes in recovery, and you know what? I've learned from them. Some of them I've had to make over and over and over, and I've learned from them. And you know what? My little white belt is getting blacker all the time. I'm getting pretty darn good at doing this thing called recovery. I don't have it perfect, believe me, but I'm a lot better than I ever was before. And I really am. Those were the kind of stories. Those were the things that started to make sense and started to click with me. We started doing our step work. This was way before there was ever a step working guide. There was no step working guide. And the only way that my sponsor knew how to do the steps was a way that she'd been taught in another fellowship. And so we did the best that we could do. We did the very best that we could do. And, you know, I started to get it. I started to get that that the problem here is me. That any time that I have a conflict with another human being, that I have a part in that. That I've either set it up or I've somehow contributed to the problem. That doesn't mean that really bad things that happened to me when I was a little kid were my fault. They were not my fault. I was powerless over that stuff. And it was very painful. It does mean that today I'm not a victim anymore. It means that today I get to stand up and be the strong, powerful woman that I am. You know, there was this thing about me is that, you know, for a long time people would say to me, you know, you're just too... you're too boisterous. You're too out there. You're too you laugh too much. You're too giggly. You're never serious. You know, and so, you know, I used to think that if people say that about me, it means that there's something wrong with me. What I know today is that who I am has to be okay with me from the inside out. That today. I didn't lie to anybody. And today I wasn't sneaky with anybody. I try to the best of my ability to live the 12 steps in my life. And what that means is that on a daily basis, I have to ask myself, what's my part in this? What could I have done differently? What could I have said differently? How could my attitude have been different? How could my behavior have been different to affect a different outcome? In whatever it is that's going on. There's nowhere in the 12 steps where it says that I get to take a look at your stuff. Nowhere. There's not one place in there. There's nowhere in there where it says it's okay for me to inventory you or to point out your defects of character. It's not okay. It's always about me. And, I'll tell you a little story about that, too. Tell you a little story about those defects of character. This is one of those, like, cartoon stories. So it's got little animated characters in it and stuff, so bear with me. But there was this farmer, and he was a potter. In his spare time, he made clay pots. And he made his first clay pot, and it didn't turn out very well. Sort of. It was kind of cracked down one side. But he really loved it because it was his first clay pot, so he decided that he was going to keep that clay pot. And then as he got better and better at his pottery, he made another clay pot, and that one was perfect. It didn't have any defect in it. And every day he would keep those two pots together in the corner of his farmhouse, and every day he'd take those two pots and he'd put them up on his shoulders, and he would fill them with water in the trough outside of his door, and he would trudge up this hill where his animals were in their, you know, where the horses were. And he would pour the water into the trough, and then he would go back down and set the clay pots down. And one day he had done that. He'd been doing it for many, 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 many months. And when he set the little clay pot down, The little crackpot said to him, "Master, why do you continue to take me up the hill every day? Every day you fill me full out of the trough, and every day you fill him full out of the trough, and every day by the time you get to the top of the hill, I'm half empty, and he's full. And so he's really serving his purpose to you, and I'm really just defective." And the master said, "You know, tomorrow when I go up the hill, I want you to really pay attention." And so in the morning when he got up, he got the two clay pots and he went out to the trough and he filled them with water. And he took the two pots up the hill and he filled the water trough at the top. And as he was making his way back down, the little clay pots were really paying attention, really looking around and seeing what they could see. And he got them back down to the farmhouse and he set the little clay pots in the corner. And he said to the little defective clay pot, he said, "What did you see on your side of the path on the way up the hill?" He said, "Well, you know, on my side there was green moss that looked like it was the color of emeralds. And there were beautiful flowers and there were shrubs of all sizes and shapes. And the flowers were all different colors, every color of the rainbow that you could imagine. And the moss looked so inviting that I wanted you to put me down and let me roll in the moss for a while." And he said to the perfect jug, he said, "What did you see on your side of the path?" He said, "Well, you know, Master, on my side of the path, it was barren and the grass was yellow and it was very dry. And sometimes when the wind would sweep through there, it would blow the dust up and I would get dirt in my eyes. And it was really not very pleasant at all." And the master turned back to the defective jug and he said, "You know, I knew from the very beginning that you were defective, and I decided that I was going to take advantage of your defects of character. And so the first day when you and I went up that hill together, I had some seeds in my pocket and I threw those seeds into the dirt. And every day when I've taken you up the hill, you've watered those seeds for all these months, and out of your defects came this beautiful garden of moss and flowers and shrubs. And so, you know, the lesson that I got in that for myself as a member of Narcotics Anonymous is that my total self-centeredness wants me to focus. The spiritual part of my disease wants me to focus on everything that's wrong with me. But the God of my understanding has figured out a way to make my defects of character work for him. And my whole job is to show up. That's my job, is to keep showing up, being a member of Narcotics Anonymous, and don't use no matter what. And you know what? God's going to find a way to make those defects of character work, so that together, he and I can plant a garden in recovery. And you know what? Me and God had a thing going on for about 20 years now. And enough time has passed that I can look back over the hill that me and him have been climbing for all this time. And you know, we really have planted a garden together. And that garden came about not because I'm perfect, but because I'm defective. And because God loves me despite my defects of character. Despite my defects of character, he's found a way to use me. You know, I feel really blessed to be here. In a couple months, I'm going to be 50 years old, and if I stay clean from now until September, I'm going to have 20 years clean in September of this year. Since this has been the most difficult year of my recovery, and I'm so grateful for every day of the time I have and all of the experience, strength, and hope that I've been able to hang on to, because I think that if I hadn't been where I was in recovery, as strong as I was in recovery, I don't know if I would have made it through this year. In June of this year, I had to have major surgery. My bladder stopped working, and I had to have surgery. And in July, my husband had surgery on his back, and in August, my sister died of metastatic colon cancer. And 6 days after we buried my sister, I had to have second surgery because I never stopped bleeding from the first surgery. And the day after I had the second surgery, my partner stole my pain meds, and within a week he was out shooting heroin. And we separated after 7 years. And in October, he overdosed and was taken by Medic One. They found him down on the streets of Seattle. They had to take him by Medic One up to Harborview Hospital. And they hit him with Narcan, and they couldn't get him to come back. And they hit him with adrenaline in his heart. They couldn't get him to come back. So kind of a last measure thing, they hit him with the defibrillators so much that he had second-degree burns on his chest. And they got him to come back. They saved his life. And he left that gurney at Harborview Hospital. And I woke up the next morning to leave my condominium to go to work, and he was sitting on my stairs, at the bottom of the stairs at my condominium, trying to shoot heroin in the Heplock that they'd put in his ankle the night before so he could be IV'd. And I convinced him I was going to take him up to Harborview to get him some pain meds. And I actually took him to the ER and then had the mental health professionals do an involuntary commitment on him. And I was able to put him into treatment. I'm really glad to tell you that he's got 7 months clean today. This program is like not necessarily for people who deserve it, because you know what? We all deserve it. It's not a matter, I can't think of anybody that deserves it more than that guy does. And there were many, many days in these 7 years when I wished that I could have taken off some of my clean time and given it to him just to get him started. And it doesn't work like that. The way that you get it is one day at a time. And in December, I had to have a third surgery because I still had not stopped bleeding. And the 22nd of December, my mom fell down the stairs and got a severe head injury at her house. The end of January, my mom had to have the first of two brain surgeries. The second was in February. And it's been 9 months now since the first surgery, and I'm still bleeding, and they don't know why. And I just got out of the hospital yesterday with a lung infection in my right lung. And, I just didn't have the heart. I remember laying in that hospital Thursday and thinking to myself, I don't have the heart to call Dawn and tell her that I can't be there. And I bet you I've had six sponsees call me today and say, Brenda, you just need to stay home and stay in bed. And I really did feel like you know how, like, you be in bed so many days? I can only be in bed so many days, and I got to, like, get up. I mean, I don't care. I'll, like, go naked out into the middle of the street and just, like, look like a crazy woman or something. But I just have to get up. That's where this was for me tonight. You know, I cannot think of any place I'd rather be than at a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, sharing my experience, strength, and hope. And I am so honored that West Puget Sound area and the Activities Committee believed that I had a message that you guys would want to hear tonight. I'm really humbled by that. And, I just think that I could never be enough or do enough or say enough. I could never do enough service work or be a good enough member to ever give back the gift that I've gotten from Narcotics Anonymous. Thanks very much for my recovery, and thank you for being here. Thanks.